Spirit of God, we ask that we might have eyes that see and ears that hear as we enter into the holy place of your word. Amen.
Amen.
The scheme for the Bible studies this week is a study of the Gospel of Mark. And I thought maybe we might start out by finding out what you already know about the Gospel of Mark. What do you know about the Gospel of Mark? Anybody?
The shortest.
It's the shortest of the four Gospels, correct. Only 16 brief chapters. Anybody else?
He keeps using the word immediately.
Yes, over and over again. Immediately, at once. Mark's gospel is very rapid moving, has a rapid pace, almost a kind of staccato pace. It moves from one thing to another. Doesn't dwell on anything for any great length of time. What else do you know? Well, in keeping...
It was one of the first written ones.
It's the oldest of the four Gospels. Scholars are pretty well agreed on that now. Written sometime between the year 66 and 70 A.D. So we're looking at a document written about a generation after the death of Jesus, from 66 to 70 A.D. Say more about that dating a little bit. The oldest of the four Gospels. And it's quite likely that the writer of Matthew and the writer of Luke both knew the Gospel of Mark and were dependent upon the Gospel of Mark to some degree. They borrow information from it. Anything else you know about Mark? Mark's Gospel? The shortest. Very rapid movement. The Gospel of Mark has very little on the sayings of Jesus. It's almost all action. There are just two places where there's a lengthy monologue recorded. I'll come back to that in a little bit. Well, maybe that's enough to at least to get us going on Mark. Now that some of the folks have arrived, everybody's arrived, right?
We're all here.
The bell didn't ring.
Yes, I rang the bell very briefly. I figured, in all modesty, it should be a short bell. I'd like to introduce myself to you. My name is Verlin Smith. You've heard the last name, you've never heard the first name. V-E-R-L-Y-N. I used to accuse my mother of having a prenatal nightmare. She could never tell me where the name came from. My parents were committed to the idea that all three of their boys should have unusual first names, so we wouldn't have the problems that John Smith and Jim Smith and Bill Smith and such people have. And they really did a humdinger on me. My other brothers are Francis and Delmar. But believe it or not, there's some other Verlin Smiths in the world. My brother ran his computer software some time ago and found about, I think it was 15 Verlin Smiths across the United States. You can imagine my surprise when I was teaching at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, where I taught for 13 years, and a young woman in our student body died, and I was asked to do her funeral in a small community outside of Sioux Falls. And after the service was over, a woman came up to me and said, "I was so surprised when I saw that name on that little bulletin the funeral director provided, because Verlyn Smith is the name of our neighbor's daughter, 16-year-old daughter." And I've met some other female Verlyns. In fact, I used to get mailings from now, Ms. Verlyn. And at one time, my American Express bill came, Ms. Verlyn Smith. And I thought it'd be kind of fun not to pay it. See if they could collect. But I wasn't courageous enough to do that. I sent in the check, nevertheless. So it's a name I have a little fun with. It's fun to be a Smith. People say, "Oh, come on, what's your real name?" One of the big things that's happened to me in the last year is that I just got married last November. Is that okay at age 69? And I'm proud to say that my bride is with me here at Holden Village, Judy Helgen. Judy is a research scientist for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in Minnesota, and is an expert on wetlands and frogs and little critters, as she calls them, live in the water. Things I haven't paid very much attention to heretofore, but I've become her student, quite obviously. Well, we decided yesterday afternoon that it would be appropriate, since we were recently married, to go up to Honeymoon Heights. Actually, we were looking for a cottage up there, but the neighborhood's a bit run down. We did find one little cottage in a very quiet neighborhood up there, but there was no for sale sign on it. No Edina Realty sign, like you see all over the Twin Cities in Minnesota. So we kind of gave up on our quest for a house in Honeymoon Heights. If you haven't been to Honeymoon Heights yet, you got to go up there. It's really quite an interesting place. That's where the brides of the miners who worked the mine here lived with their newly married. And as Judy and I were saying to each other, those poor miners, they had to work all day in the mine and then walk that long distance up there. They weren't ready for much of a honeymoon. And I can't imagine that those brides who came here could have seen that as a particularly desirable place to live. The winter time, there are two avalanches close by, and I can imagine those brides saying, "Well, I'm not sure this marriage is going to work." But an interesting hike up there. I taught at Augustana College for 13 years. I was with campus ministry here on the West Coast. I was the director for a 10-state diocese with campus ministers in all of the major universities in these 10 states. That was my little responsibility. And then moved to the Twin Cities in 1976, where I was on the campus ministry staff. And then retired 5 years ago, when I could cash in my pension and Social Security and become a Medicare card carrier, like I trust some of you folks. Some of you look old enough to be Medicare. And the last parish I served was Grace University Lutheran Church, which sits right next to the University Hospital on the Minneapolis campus of the university. So I've been in college all my life. I never graduated, never want to. Since retirement, I had three delightful winters in Thousand Oaks, California, part of the religion faculty, adjunct to the religion faculty at California Lutheran University. So you know that school. I'm delighted to be here, and I hope you are too. A wonderful place, Holden Village. Well, let's go back to Mark. That was a little parenthesis. We moved from Mark to Berlyn for a little bit and then back to that. The study we're going to do this week is based upon, or I'd rather say inspired by, a book written by Ched Myers. Ched Myers is an interesting man. He is a scholar, but he's not associated with any university. He's deliberately not had that kind of association, so he could be a freelance writer. Lives in the Los Angeles area, California. His book is entitled Binding the Strong Man. Little book of about 500 pages that we can very easily cover in five sessions, right? Binding the Strong Man, with the subtitle A Political Reading of Mark's Story of Jesus. A political reading of Mark's story of Jesus. We'll find out why he says political reading. That'll become very clear to us very soon. Walter Wink, whom some of you may know, he's a writer who's gained a lot of reputation, says, quite simply, this is the most important commentary on a book of scripture since Barth's Romans. Wow. Would that I should ever have anybody say that about something I do. I'm sure a lot of people would say that's a bit of an extravagant claim, but it's a claim made by a person who is of high reputation. Quite simply, the most important commentary on a book of scripture since Barth's Romans. Many of the things that we're going to talk about these hours will be things that you'll have difficulty agreeing with. I think of Myers' book as an alternative interpretation of the Gospel of Mark, alternative to some of the more traditional approaches to the Gospel. And I present this to you, and I want to be very clear about this, I present this to you not as the way to read the Gospel of Mark, but as a way to read the Gospel of Mark. And I would say, maybe you will not agree, I would say a legitimate way to read the Gospel of Mark. My hope is that you will open yourself to this interpretation, listen to what he's saying, and make that part of the grist for your mill, on the assumption that this is not the last time you'll read the Gospel of Mark. You're going to be reading that book again and again. And my hope is that this will give you a fresh perspective that will add another dimension to the way in which you've understood some of this material before. I have no need to have you all agree with Ched Myers by the time we're done. I'm not the least bit defensive about this book. Maybe if Myers were sitting here, he'd be very upset about my saying that, but that's the way I feel. But what I do believe is that it's a worthwhile way of looking at the Gospel of Mark that can add something to the way in which you read that book into the future. My suggestion would be that if you want to stay with this process through the week, that sometime very soon, today, tomorrow, you take your Bible and sit down and read the Gospel of Mark from start to finish. If you can do it in one sitting, that'd be excellent. And as you do that, think to yourself, how would my understanding of Jesus and perhaps the whole ministry of the church, our teaching and preaching, be different if all we had was the Gospel of Mark? That we did not have Matthew, Luke, and John. All we had was Mark. How would it be different? What difference would that make? Well, one thing you discover very quickly is that Mark has nothing about the birth and early life of Jesus at all. It starts out with the baptism of Jesus. The birth narrative comes from Luke, we read it at Christmas time, and from Matthew about the wise men. And the Gospel of Mark has none of the so-called post-resurrection appearances of Jesus. Jesus by the side of the lake when the disciples wonder who he is and all of those, the Emmaus Road, some of those things. There's none of that in the Gospel of Mark. The Gospel of Mark is clearly not a biography. No worthwhile biography would begin with the 30th year of a person's life. All of these 16 chapters are devoted to what are generally believed to be the 3 years of Jesus' ministry. And seven of the chapters are on the last 7 days of Jesus' life. The last seven chapters. So we clearly do not have any effort at offering a biography of Jesus. Well, what do we have here? What do we have in the Gospel of Mark? That's the question before us. What is this? How did this get written? What's it all about? What's the intention of the writer in putting this book together? And that's where I think Ched Meyers' approach is very, very interesting, very provocative. So let's talk about that for a little bit. But before I get into that, let's just stop. I like to talk a while and then stop and find out if you're still with me. And if there are any questions or anything you want to talk about right now, got a speech coming on, you know what that feels like? It starts down here. Rest my throat for a minute. Anybody? Well, let's dive in then. Ched Meyers believes that the Gospel of Mark was written by somebody whose name we don't know. We'll call him Mark, because I just don't want to keep on saying the writer of the Gospel of Mark. We'll just call him Mark. Who lived in the northern part of Palestine. I used to draw a map of Palestine for Sunday school classes. It looked something like this. That's not very good. None of this is very good. This is the Dead Sea. This is the Sea of Galilee. Does it look familiar? This is the Jordan River. And Palestine was divided into three parts. These borders are not very fixed. They're very fluid borders. The northern part of Palestine.
Samaria.
Oh, Galilee. The middle part was called
Samaria.
And the southern part was called
Judea.
That's where the word Jew comes from. And Jerusalem was located right in here somewhere. Capernaum, which we'll look at soon, was up here on the Sea of Galilee. Ched Meyers follows traditional scholarship in seeing two books in the Gospel of Mark, two acts in the drama, if you will, first act, second act. The first book takes place in Galilee, the northern part of Palestine, what we now think of as Palestine. Book one, and book two takes place, for the most part, in Judea. The very different mood in these two books, as you'll see if you sit down and read the whole thing today. You'll see that in book one, which ends in the middle of the eighth chapter, right in here, 810 to 822. In the first book, the ministry of Jesus is a very public ministry. He's speaking to the crowds. The word crowd appears in the Gospel of Mark 38 times.
Whoa.
Over and over again, the crowds. The old version, King James Version, I think says multitudes. The word I like is masses, because the word masses implies common folk, right? And these people were unlearned. They were illiterate for the most part. Masses also has the connotation of being totally unstructured, totally unorganized, just people that happened along. They were not an organized crowd. They hadn't bought tickets to the Metrodome to cheer for the Vikings. They were just there. They were just people on the street or up in the countryside. And Jesus is preaching, teaching, working with the crowds, the masses. While in the second book, the ministry is much more private. That's not a very good word. But what I mean to say is, here he's dealing with a much smaller group of people, the people we think of as the disciples. And when we say disciples in this context, we're not just talking about the 12, because there were women among them. Very clearly, we'll see very clearly there were women among them. And we don't know how many people. But a smaller group of people, his followers, his students. The word disciple means student or follower. He was the rabbi. They followed him closely, lived with him. And these are the people that he now wants to prepare for his death in Jerusalem and train them, as it were, for leadership in the community that's to issue out of his ministry, right? So we move from a public ministry to a much more private kind of tutorial, if you will, ministry to among those close followers of his, whom he will call to be his disciples up in Galilee. So the whole story begins in Galilee, as Mark sees it. And it issues out of a community, a small group of people in Galilee, who are committed to a vision of what, a vision of possibilities, a vision of what the world can be. It's a very radical vision, very, very radical vision. We need to understand that, how radical this vision is. It may not seem radical to us, but in that day it was exceedingly radical. And it was radical because it was opposed to all oppression. The oppressors of various kinds in their community, the power groups that held people in bondage in various ways. What they seek to do is to liberate people, to create a community, a world, if you will, in which people are liberated from bondage. It's very egalitarian in its vision. And here's where its radicality becomes very obvious. They believed that all of the people who are oppressed should be lifted up. That includes women, very definitely women. In Mark, there's a lot of emphasis on Jesus' acceptance of women. You women may feel that you're oppressed in our society, and you are. You are, in many ways. But in the ancient world, women were nothing. Women had no legal rights. If a woman didn't have a man, she really didn't have any identity. If a woman was widowed, she had very little that she could do except to become a beggar or a prostitute if she didn't have a man in her life. She couldn't hold property. There was no social security system. There was no way that women were taken care of. Women were vessels for men, for men's enjoyment and for reproduction. They had utilitarian value. They did not have intrinsic value. But in this community that Mark comes out of, He wants men and women to be equal in every respect. Very radical idea in that world. He also wants Gentiles and Jews to be seen as equal. Now, the Jewish people of that day certainly did not see the Gentiles as their equals. You probably know that this word Gentiles is simply a translation of the word the nations. From the standpoint of the Jewish people, there are us Jews who were called by God, Abraham, the covenant, the whole history. And then there are all the other people, the Gentiles. Anyone who's not a Jew is a Gentile. So there was a lot of looking down one's long nose like mine by Jews looking down at Gentiles as outcasts and of much less importance socially, politically, and certainly before God, not having the same kind of status at all that Jewish people did, the chosen people, the covenant people. Children were to be revered. They were to be equal to adults. Not just things, not just nuisances. Remember, let the little children come unto me. Except you become a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom. The emphasis is upon the importance of children and the poor. The poor were always looked upon by the rich. And is this still true today? As somehow less worthy. We have this awful expression, how much are you worth? That's asking how much is in your bank account and in your stock portfolio. How much are you worth? The idea is the poor are to be cherished and are to be liberated from the oppression of their poverty in this radical community. So this community found itself in opposition to all the forces that created this kind of oppression in their society. And there were powerful forces at work in the world of that day, between 66 and 70. One of the major forces was the power of the Romans, the Roman Empire, and its great armies ruled Palestine as it did all the world, the known world at that time, a magnificent empire, and ruled with might, power. We think of Pontius Pilate, the centurions at the time of Jesus' crucifixion. Another great power was the religious authorities of the day. The centered in the temple in Jerusalem. This was the great center of Jewish religious life. And these people had enormous power. The temple was the economic center of Jerusalem. The biggest tourist attraction in town. The thing that brought great wealth into Jerusalem. Think of the people coming and buying turtle doves and the commercial life that centered around the temple. So it was not only a religious reality, a religious power, but it was an economic power and a political power. And the authorities around the temple, the scribes, were the PhDs, the seminary professors of that day, and the Sadducees, the scribes and the Sadducees. And there were other powers. There was the power of what Myers calls the Jewish nationalists. These are sometimes referred to as zealots. These are the people who took up arms against the Roman Empire and were hoping to be able to overthrow the empire and bring about the independence of the Jewish people again. The Jewish people had had less than 100 years of independence since the destruction of the first temple in 586 BC when they went into exile. A short period of time under the Maccabees, that independence ended when the Romans took over Palestine in 63 BC. But these guerrilla fighters, people rose up. It looked for a time around 68 AD like maybe they would succeed. But then the armies came in, the Roman armies came in, and in the year 70 AD, just wiped out the city of Jerusalem and destroyed the second temple, a temple that's never been rebuilt since that time. The center of Jewish religious life was gone. But these were people who believed that the way in which the new world could be developed is through military power against Rome. And we'll see that the Markan community doesn't agree with that at all. Then there were some reformist groups, some who thought, well, the situation isn't all that bad. If we could just tinker with it in this way or this way, we could fix it up a little bit. Among them are the Pharisees. We learned last night they weren't such bad guys after all. And the Essenes, remember them in connection with the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is a group that withdrew into the desert and developed a colony. And what they believed was that we can live under the Roman Empire. We can live with the oppression, provided that we just make a few little adjustments here and there in our own lives. No. The Markan community was opposed to all of these. And a key issue in that was the commitment on the part of the Markan community to non-violence. Think of Gandhi. Think of Martin Luther King. Now, it's important when we talk about nonviolence to understand that the commitment to nonviolence was not only a strategic one. Think about Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was committed to nonviolence not only because he believed that if the black people rose up with weaponry, they would be very quickly put down by the power of the United States military. That's a strategic decision, tactical decision, right? No, the commitment to nonviolence was a moral commitment, believing that this is the only way, the only godly way for the people of God to function in the world. Violence is in opposition to the things of God. Violence is immoral. Deeply, deeply immoral. And violence always perpetuates violence. Dom Helder Kammerer has a little book called The Spiral of Violence, in which he says violence always leads to more violence. Always. And the only way to break the cycle of violence is with nonviolence. To cut off the violence with a deep commitment to the idea that this is the only way, the only way. In fact, some people will say it's not the way. Violence is not the way to peace. Violence is what peace is all about. Nonviolence is what peace is all about. That's the commitment of this community. Let's stop there. Any questions about that? Tried to give you a sense of what this community is all about and what they're up against. They're up against enormous forces.
Yeah. One of the other things that it would seem to me would be good to mention maybe at this point too is that while they were up against these people, all these people are also, groups are going to also be trying to cool them out.
Absolutely.
And or else try to get them to join somehow their cause, so yep, that way they will be cooled out and made a part of this contribution that they would like to make.
That's right. For that, thank you very much. That's absolutely the case. Myers says that the Jewish nationalists, for example, were always trying to recruit the young people out of the Markan community. if a good patriotic Jew will join us, right? What does that sound like? Think you ever heard?
You are me too.
Do you equate the Markham community with the Christian church then?
But one of the things that Myers does not do in this book, though he has more recently published another book called Who Will Roll Away the Stone? And in this book, he promised us that second volume. I haven't seen that second volume. It's recently out. And my hope is that he's done something there to be explicit about the connection between this Markham community and the community that we see in the book of Acts, the early Christian community in Jerusalem. He doesn't do that in this book, and I'm not sure what he would say about that. I don't quite understand how you could argue against the notion that there's some kind of continuity here. That the community that we're talking about in Mark, if Myers is right, issues into the community that we find in Jerusalem somewhat later. Well, I guess we find it earlier because that community is already underway in the sixth decade after Jesus.
Wouldn't Myers want to say that that Mark is being critical of the Jerusalem community and that the Jerusalem community has lost some of the energy and the focus of the original Jesus teachings, so that I think the author of Mark and the author of Luke would be in dispute about what it means to be the church, ultimately.
Good. I don't know whether that would be what Myers would say. That's quite possible. Maybe you've heard him talk on this.
He was here last year. And
yeah, I know he has been.
And has read his book very closely. I don't know if you've done so much. But the book has been around, and we've been, you know, working on it.
The new one.
In fact, the sermon that I preached last night was from the new book. I mean, it's ideas that he developed in that new book.
Also in Marcus Bork.
Yeah, exactly. You knew what I was talking about.
Oh, I know very well what you're talking about.
What was the name of that new book again?
Who Will Roll Away the Stone? Now, I'd like to say a little bit more about what you were talking about last night, probably tomorrow morning, you know, the purity code. Mark portrays Jesus as very definitely in opposition to the purity code of the Jewish leaders, religious leaders in Jerusalem. Thank you for that. That question came up when I was doing the same study 4 years ago, and I've never tracked it down. I'm glad for the question. Anybody else?
Well, would nonviolence have applied with the Nazis? Seems like in an imperfect world that nonviolence has its limitations also.
Well, I'm trying to decide whether we should get into a debate on nonviolence. I think that could be an endless discussion, and it'd be an interesting discussion.
I think the really quick answer to that is if we spend as much money on nonviolence as we spend on preparing for violence, that nonviolence would have worked in the German Nazi era. I mean, we would be training our children and training ourselves about how to love people that we're scared of. We'd have a leg up on that, but we never ever deal with that. And as Christians, it's kind of to our shame, I think, that we don't investigate this more. I mean, even with our neighbors, when our neighbors yell at us or something, we yell back, and it's just a spiral of violence.
A number of folks much closer to the scene than obviously I was have said that if the Christian church in Germany, which is predominantly Lutheran and Catholic, and I shall do this without sounding too pejorative, had been faithful, been alert, instead of allowing themselves to be sort of sucked into this violence, form of violence that Nazism represented, Hitler wouldn't have had a chance. He could never have made it in Germany. And that seems to me to be very clear. As Germany was and is a country of high culture and great human sensitivity, it simply was not necessary that cheap paper hanger could take over that magnificent country. And a lot of people let it happen. And that's a kind of alertness that it seems to me all of us ought to have in the forepart of our minds continuously when we look at our own nation and the political situation, social situation, and the kinds of oppression that prevails in this country.
But that thesis, when carried a little too far, seems to delete scriptural discipline. So like even parents who fail to discipline their children, there is a discipline within discipleship. In fact, the very word disciple really has to do with discipline.
There is no contradiction between discipline and nonviolence. In fact, nonviolence requires the utmost of discipline. Martin Luther King went into the various demonstrations. They trained people in discipline, trained them so that they would not clench their fists and do what any of us would do when the water hoses and the dogs were set against us, to simply lie down. Active nonviolence.
You can't confuse discipline with punishment.
No, discipline and punishment are not the same thing, are they?
No.
And when we talk about disciplining our kids, I hope we're not talking about whacking them over the head.
Right. Yeah.
We're talking about training, teaching, discipling.
Our then children. We get into semantics and all of that.
Yeah, but very important distinctions in those semantics.
Well, I think we have to face the fact there's a long tradition of violence in Hebrew scriptures. I mean, yes. Always clobbering the enemy, warlike. You have the God who is on their side to clobber the enemy. In Leviticus is that nice little passage about discipline, that if you have an unruly son, you should stone him to death. I mean, it's there.
Yeah. Yes. And all of the implications of this are not drawn out in what Myers gives us here. It seems to me very clear that what Myers sees is that Mark is portraying Jesus as standing in opposition to a whole bunch of that Hebrew tradition. Because that Hebrew tradition is what these Jewish, religious authorities in the temple were living on day by day. And that really gets us into the purity code stuff that Jeff was talking about last night.
For a nonviolent society, you must have self-discipline.
Very much so.
With discipline, but it's self-discipline.
Yep. And I think certainly in teaching our children, there's a discipline that children must learn. Well, my dad always taught me, and I've never wondered whether it was wise, that if you're confronted with a bully, ignore it. Walk away. Andy Gates was the bully on our playground. I remember him vividly.
great big burly guy. He would beat on the little kids. I was tall, but I was very skinny. I weighed 140 pounds and 6 feet tall, and I was 13. So I was just a squirt. And he could have beat the living daylights out of me. And I used to wonder if Dad's counsel was good. It sounded cowardly, you know. Some guys would take Andy on. My dad always said, come on, Hank. Just walk away. You don't need that fight. You don't need to win that.
Others would say, beat him up and teach him a lesson.
Yeah, right. I wasn't the one to do that. Not with Andy. I don't really feel that my dad taught me nonviolence. I think what he taught me was fear. And he might have said that in a different way that would have been more helpful in terms of what we're talking about. My dad was a very nonviolent man, a very gentle, kind man, and a wonderful model for his three sons. Well, let's see, what else we got here in this marvelous notes? All right, this brings us to Ched Meyer's understanding of why this gospel was written, why the Gospel of Mark was written. I like to use the word tract in thinking about the Gospel of Mark. The word gospel is kind of loaded. It's got a lot of churchy stuff in it. So I think of it as a tract. What Meyer says is that Mark, the author of the tract, is writing this account not to give us a biography of Jesus. We've already decided that, right? But to be an encouragement to this community, to help to enhance the solidarity of the community, because the community was always in danger of disintegration, as you said. It was always in danger of people becoming weary and burned out. We've been trying to preach and teach this nonviolent message, and nobody pays any attention. And it looks like all of these powerful people over here are getting all the victories. They're the ones who are making it, and we're not making it. So there was always a danger of the young people putting on the uniform and going into violence. And there was also a danger of a certain kind of betrayal that might happen within the community. Think about Judas. So Mark is trying to say to the people, hang in there. This is the way that Jesus would have us be, have us live. This is the vision. This is our ministry. This is our goal. A call to radical discipleship. There's that word, discipleship, again. That term is used over and over again by Myers. Radical discipleship. If you want to think about it this way, Mark portrays Jesus as calling disciples to radical discipleship. Mark, in writing his tract, is calling people to radical discipleship. And Ched Meyers, in talking about Mark's account of Jesus, is calling us to radical discipleship. The purpose of his book is to call us into that kind of radicality. That the church might be committed to radical discipleship. Yes, please.
But with an understanding of what the word radical means. Getting to the root of things.
How do you understand?
Well, the radix, the word radix is there. And it means getting back to the basics, basically. And so, what Jesus is calling them to, and most certainly the marketing community is calling them to, is the basic life with God. And so there's a lot of simplification in Mark amidst the multiplicity of issues that are dealt with to get to the root of the matter.
But keeping these
these oppressed groups in mind. He really is asking that the whole society be turned upside down. That we not just give women a little bit of jollies. Remove the glass ceiling or whatever. But that women are equal to men. That's radical today. The children, the poor. Think about our attitude toward welfare. Well, Jeff said it last night. In the ancient world, the understanding, it wasn't always made explicit, but the understanding among the Jewish people pretty much was, if you're poor, that's some indication that God is not caring for you in the same way as he's caring for me. There are all kinds of places where the statement is made in the Old Testament that God will give people, will bless people with riches, the land of flowing with milk and honey. So the rich person can say, well, I've been a clear indication that God's on my side. And that whole notion has to go. That whole notion has to go. If you really are willing to give yourself to radical discipleship. Just think what our society would be like if we could internalize this vision. Think what your congregation would be like. The Catholic bishops in Latin America several years ago came up with the statement, preferential option for the poor. Are you familiar with that statement?
Yes.
They were aware that in Latin America, the Catholic Church had always been on the side of the rich. And the poor people would come and bring their tithes to the church. And the priest would say, well, I know you're poor, but you know, that's sort of the deck that God dealt you. Someday when you die, you will have riches in heaven. Beautiful message. And now the Latin bishops are saying, Catholic bishops are saying, no, you have to turn that upside down. And the church has to give preferential option to the poor. When I heard about that, I asked my congregation in a sermon, how would life at Grace University Lutheran Church be different? Let's think about that together as a community. How would life at in our congregation be different if we genuinely gave preferential option to the poor? Wow! That's mind-blowing. We simply do not do that. We simply have not captured that vision, even for our churches, not to say the total society. That's begins to get at the radical nature of the vision of this community, and the radical nature of the vision that Mark is holding out for his community. And his interpreter, in this case, is holding out for all of us. Now, we have not gotten into the gospel itself, but this background is very important if we're going to understand how Myers interprets things. And I decided that I would like to conclude each of our sessions with a quotation from a little book by one of the Latin American liberation theologians, Leonardo Boff, B-O-F-F, called Way of the Cross, Way of Justice. It's based upon the Catholic Stations of the Cross, if you're familiar with that liturgy that they use with six stations on each side of the nave of the church. And he has some statements in here that are very pertinent. Actually, the one I'm going to read now would be more pertinent if we'd gotten into what I hope we'd get to today, but we didn't get to it yet. But we'll get to it next time. So here we go. I'm going to read this as our concluding thought. Jesus announced the newness of the kingdom or reign of God. That meant that the complete, definitive liberation of humankind and the world was at hand. Jesus' miracles demonstrated this clearly. This liberation, which brings life, grace, justice, love, and peace, begins with those most in need of it, the poor, who are treated unjustly by the rich, the sick, who are thrust off to the margins of society, and sinners, who are expelled from the precincts of religion. Access to this liberation granted by God is not achieved by a mere wave of some magic wand. People must undergo a conversion, must change their way of thinking and acting. Only to those who undergo conversion is the kingdom good news. To others, it is a judgment, a piece of bad news. And it is good news because the reality of evil is transformed into a reality of goodness, thanks to conversion. Conversion implies overcoming the objective causes that generate sin, produce injustices, and distill death. Without conversion, the kingdom does not come, nor does liberation take place. Conversion calls for ruptures that will necessarily entail conflicts.